Chapter 25. A team led by Mike Trono was heading to the bay where the silent sea lay on the bottom even before Juan and the others returned to the Oregon. Juan had radioed his instructions for them to take the larger Nomad back up north and get to work on making the wreck disappear. Mike had five others with him and almost a ton of gear crammed into the submersible. They were in for a cold, miserable night. After what was the longest, hottest shower of Juan's life, and learning that the Argentine's survey boat hadn't spent more than an hour in the wrong location before coming back to base, he met with his department heads to go over the next phase of their operation. The meeting went quickly. In the idle hours motoring back from the wreck site, Cabrillo had developed a plan that needed little refinement. He was back in the moon pool less than 2 hours after returning home. Rather than take the time to recharge the Discovery's batteries, technicians swapped them out for fresh ones, and they changed the carbon dioxide scrubbers and refilled all her air tanks as well. For this mission, Juan chose Franklin Lincoln to accompany him. He wasn't expecting any gunplay, but the big former SEAL moved like a wraith despite his size and had been on more covert insertions than almost the rest of the crew combined. By the time they were ready to leave, Kevin Nixon arrived with Arctic clothing his staff had modified to closer resemble the gear the Argentines wore. Once they were bundled into the jackets, pants, hoods, scarves, and goggles, they would be completely anonymous. It took them 10 minutes to enter the Narrows. Even submerged, they could see the aura of lights on the far shore. With machinery on the oil platforms banging and whining, the waters sounded like a wrecking yard. The industrial clatter masked the sound of their motors, so there was no need for stealth as they started across. "What's that noise?" Link asked as they were gliding along at 30 feet.
"The oil platforms?"
"No. Like a low-frequency gurgling sound. It was really strong when we first entered the bay, and while it's gotten quieter, I can still hear it." Juan concentrated, and he too picked up the strange tones. He chanced turning on one of the weaker floodlights. From the surface, it would look like the moon's reflection off a wave. In its glow, he saw curtains of tiny bubbles rising up from the seafloor. And as his eyes adjusted further, he and Link spotted the lattice of pipes laid across the ooze and how they were the source of the bubbles. He killed the lights, and the two men shared a look.
"Any ideas?" Link finally asked.
"That's how they keep the bay free from ice."
He checked one of the computer displays.
"Yep, that's it. The water temperature is near 60 degrees. They must use the vented gas from the oil platform to heat air and force it through the pipes. Pretty ingenious when you think about it."
Moments later, they passed within 100 yards of the big cruiser resting at anchor.
"Any thoughts about what we're going to do about her?"
Juan could almost sense its dark presence in the inky water, like some great predatory shark. A fight between the Oregon and the cruiser would be short and brutal, and would most likely end with both ships on the bottom.
"Hopefully, inspiration will strike tonight."
20 yards short of the piers, Cabrillo extended the Discovery's low-light television periscope. It was no bigger than a pack of cigarettes, and the pictures it took went to an HD display in the sub, as well as aboard the Oregon. A dozen sets of eyes studied the docks as Juan panned the camera back and forth for the next few minutes. Other than the workboats tied to the pier, there was nothing to see but concrete pylons. It was simply too cold for men to stand watch for any significant period of time. Cabrillo also suspected that, for now, the Argentines were feeling good about their accomplishment and didn't believe they were in any danger yet. Later, perhaps, there would be an armed response, but for the next few days the world would continue to reel from their audacious play. He guided the sub under the dock and slowly brought her to the surface. Less than 8 inches of her hull broached, and the combing around her hatch was a mere 5 inches taller. With her hull painted a deep blue, the submersible was all but invisible. Add to that, an observer aboard the workboat would have to be on his knees and looking under the pier, so their chance of detection was virtually zero. The two men felt like a couple of contortionists when they donned their parkas, but a few moments later, Link popped the hatch and climbed up onto the deck. There was little clearance, and he had to work stooped over as he tied off the submersible so it wouldn't move when the tide changed. Cabrillo stepped off the mini-sub and onto the port side of one of the workboats. Link climbed up next to him, and as if they didn't have a care in the world, they moved onto the dock and approached the Argentine base. This was the first good look Juan had of the facility, and he was amazed by its size and scope. He knew from Linda's pictures that there was room around the bay to more than triple its size. Given free rein, there would be a real town here before too long. The first order of business was to locate where the Argies were keeping the international scientists they had kidnapped and were using as human shields. It was 8 o'clock at night, and as they suspected, there were hardly any people about. They saw an occasional shape moving amid the buildings, but most people were wisely inside. When they peered through the occasional lit window, they could see men lounging around on sofas watching DVDs or playing cards in rec rooms or in their own private bedrooms reading books or writing letters home. The first area they checked seemed to be dorms for the oil workers, an unlikely candidate. They searched several warehouses, thinking the scientists could be tucked into a back room, but found nothing but oil equipment and hundreds of drums of a drill lubricant called mud. When they were coming out of one of the buildings, a dark figure was waiting by the door. "What were you doing in there?" he demanded, his voice muffled by a scarf, but the accusatory tone unmistakable. "Trying to figure the place out," Juan answered in Spanish. The stranger was dressed as a civilian, so he went on the offense. "If we're to defend you guys, I need to know every square inch of this place. So if you don't mind, we will get back to it." "Yeah?" He was still suspicious. "Then why skulk around at night?" Juan made a gesture to Link that said, "Can you believe this guy?" and replied, "Because I very much doubt the Americans will be sporting enough to attack during the day, and what looks like cover when it's bright may not be so good in the dark." With that, Juan's shoulder bumped the guy as he passed, and he and Link moved on without a backward glance. When they were out of sight behind the rounded corner of a dormitory, Juan did look back and saw their interrogator had vanished. Link chuckled. "My Spanish may be rusty, but that sure sounded like a line of the purest bull I have ever heard." "I was just telling Max that the more outrageous the lie, the more likely it'll be believed." Because the facility was designed to be camouflaged from satellite observation, it was not laid out in a neat, efficient grid. It wasn't until they were at the very southern edge of the base, near where Link had earlier spotted a hidden SAM battery, that they saw a lone building on stilts shaped like an igloo lozenge. Light spilled from the window in front, but the rest were darkened. They climbed the steps. Juan opened the outer door, and he and Link stepped into a vestibule lined with pegs on the wall for parkas and racks for overboots. Neither man made to remove their clothing, and they just casually opened the door into the structure. Two soldiers were on their feet, both with pistols drawn. They had heard the outer door open and close and were on alert. When they saw it was two soldiers wearing Argentine gear, they relaxed. The room had all the charm and ambiance of a broken-down trailer.
"What are you guys doing here? We've got duty until 2200 hours.
"Sorry, we're not here to relieve you," Juan said. "We were sent to look for the Major. Has he been around?"
"Espinosa was here checking on our prisoners about 2 hours ago."
The guard gestured to a locked door behind him.
"Haven't seen him since."
Now Juan had a name to go along with the face.
"Okay, thanks."
They turned to go.
"Hold on. Who is that under there, Ramon?"
Bold as brass, he said,
"No, Juan Cabrillo."
"Who?"
"Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo. I just transferred into 9th Brigade from MI.
Meaning military intelligence. Meaning I'm probably an officer, so you'd better cut your questions short."
"Yes, sir,"
the trooper said, swallowing hard.
"If I see Major Espinosa, I'll be sure to tell him you're looking for him."
It was difficult to put menace in his voice because he was so bundled up, but Juan managed when he said, "Best if this discussion didn't take place, Private."
"Understood."
"Sir."
"Yes, sir."
Link and Cabrillo returned to the blistering cold night where the stars shone so brightly that the surrounding ice glowed.
"Bingo," Link said.
"Bingo indeed. Now we just have to rescue the hostages, close this place down, and neutralize an 8,000-ton cruiser without the Argentines realizing we were ever here."
The two men continued to reconnoiter for another 3 hours, moving freely about the base. It seemed nothing was off-limits, with the exception of the makeshift jail. Juan was acutely interested in the oil and gas processing plants. They were located in huge hangar-sized buildings that were covered in insulating layers, and then snow and ice. Inside each was an industrial-sized tangle of pipes and conduits that joined and diverged in a system only an engineer could understand. One of the plants was set well back from the beach. The other was partially built over the water on stilts driven into the seafloor. Not only was natural gas processed in this structure, but they discovered the massive furnace used to keep superheated air flowing through the pipes under the bay. Everything appeared fully automated, but such importance was placed on this key system that a workman sat watch in an enclosed office a short distance away. He nodded to what he thought were two soldiers when he spotted Link and Cabrillo. They waved back, and the worker returned to his anatomy magazine. By the time they returned to the dock, it was past 11. Both men were exhausted and chilled to the core. They jumped for the workboat, and Juan was just ducking under the pier to get onto the submersible when a guard shouted, "Stop right there! What are you doing out after curfew?" Juan straightened.
"I forgot my iPod this afternoon when I went out with the Chinese surveyors."
"I don't care what you forgot. No one is allowed outside after curfew. Get up out of there. You're coming with me."
He brought up his machine pistol.
"Easy, pal," Juan said calmly, thinking it was just rotten luck they were found by the most dedicated soldier in the Argentine army.
"We don't want any trouble."
"Then you should have stayed in your bunk. Move it."
Link was the first to step onto the dock. The guard unconsciously backed off a pace when he saw the size of one of his prisoners. Link was almost a full head taller and looked like a polar bear under his thick Arctic clothing. Juan came up next to him, but before the guard could issue any more orders, the chairman lunged forward and pushed on the heckler and coke to ease off any pressure the Argentine had on the trigger, and at the same time he swung his right fist into the man's face. His hand hit the sentry's goggles, which crushed into his nose, drawing equal measures of blood and tears. Link moved in, stripping away the weapon and crashing a boot into the man's knee. The man went down, with Cabrillo staying on top of him to smother his cries. Juan didn't hesitate. The stakes were too high. He got his hand over the guard's nose and mouth and held them closed as the man struggled to free himself. It lasted less than a minute.
"Damn. I didn't want to have to do that," he panted and stood. His hands were bloody.
"What do we do with him? If we take him with us, it might look suspicious. This isn't the kind of place you desert from."
Juan pulled back the guard's parka hood and stripped off a woolen balaclava. He then smeared the man's blood on a nearby bollard and positioned the body so it looked as though he had tripped, knocking himself unconscious and loosening his head protection. 10 minutes in such an exposed position was all it would take for the cold temperature to kill.
"Problem solved. Let's go home."
The following morning, Cabrillo was awakened by the sound of a telephone. The mound of blankets over his bed weighed a ton, and he'd slept in sweats. Still, he felt cold. It reminded him of those frosty Kazakh mornings when he had infiltrated the Baikonur Cosmodrome back in his CIA days. He snaked a hand out from under the covers and grabbed the headset from his bedside table.
"Hello."
It was 8:15. He'd overslept.
"Where are you?"
It was Overholt at Langley.
"In bed, actually."
"Are you anywhere near Antarctica?" The tone was sharp,
accusatory. Whatever pressure Langston was under, he was making sure Juan felt it too.
"We're halfway to Cape Town for the Emir of Kuwait's visit," Cabrillo said so smoothly he half believed it himself.
"You sure?"
"Lang? I've got a couple $1 million worth of navigational gear crammed into the Oregon. I think I know where we are. Mind telling me what has your tidy-whities in a twist?"
"You know that sub the Chinese sent down to protect the Argentines?"
"I recall you mentioning they were headed that way."
"The People's Liberation Army Navy has lost contact with her after she was ordered to investigate a freighter wandering into their exclusionary zone. That was 36 hours ago."
"I promise you, we were east of the Falklands by then, halfway to St. Helena Island."
"Thank God." Juan had never heard his friend so despondent.
"What's going on?"
"Since losing that sub, the Chinese have been on a tear. They claim we sank it, but they have no proof. They say that any overt act against the Argentines, no matter who does it, will be seen as an attack by the United States. If something does happen down there, they will recall all outstanding American debt. That's $750 billion. We'll be ruined completely because everyone else holding treasuries and bonds will call them too. It'll be like the bank runs at the start of the Depression. Through diplomatic channels, we got word to them that if they did call the debt, we would slap them with tariffs so no one here would buy their goods. In essence, they dared us. They don't care if their people are out of work and starving. When it comes to economic attrition, they can bury us. We've outsourced and borrowed ourselves into a corner, and now we're going to pay the price."
"They said overt act?"
"Overt, covert, it doesn't matter. They have us over a barrel. End of story. The president has ordered any U.S. warships in the Atlantic to stay above the equator, and he's recalling all our fast-attack submarines to show the Chinese that we won't interfere with what they and the Argentines have done. As of today, the United States has ceded its superpower status to the Chinese." Coming from a man who had played a significant role in ending the Soviet Union's bid for world domination, those last words were especially painful to hear. Juan didn't know what to say, and as of this moment wasn't sure what he was going to do. The right thing was to keep with his plan and let the chips fall where they may. However, he had to consider what would happen to the people back home. What Overholt described would make the Great Depression sound like a boom time. 60% or 70% unemployment, hunger and the violence it inevitably spawned, the breakdown of the rule of law. In essence, it would be the end of the United States. He finally found his voice.
"Well, you don't have to worry about us. Like I told you, we're on our way to South Africa."
"I guess I'm glad to hear it," Langston said wearily. "You know, Juan, we still might not get out of this so easily."
"What do you mean?"
"We can placate the Chinese, but North Korea's demanding we draw down the number of soldiers we have in the south or risk a military confrontation. And last night a small bomb went off near the presidential palace in Caracas. The Venezuelans are claiming it was an assassination plot perpetrated by Colombian special forces. They've vowed revenge, and a check of satellite imagery shows them moving troops to the border. Interestingly, they started a couple of days ago."
"Which means they probably set it off themselves for a pretext."
"That's my read on it, too, but it doesn't matter. China's heavily invested in Venezuela, so you can imagine our reaction if they do invade Colombia."
"Thumb twiddling?"
"That might be seen as too provocative," Overholt said with gallows humor. "We'll probably sit on our hands instead."
"Listen, I've got a full slate of meetings this morning. I'll talk to you later about any new developments. Give my best to the Kuwaiti Emir if we don't speak before you get there."
"I'm sure we will," Juan replied.
He replaced the handset and threw off his blankets. The floor was as cold as a hockey rink and just as slippery under Juan's woolen hunting socks. He wasn't sure who was better at playing the game. Him for lying to Overholt, or Langston for trying to manipulate him. The veteran CIA minder did think that the Oregon was heading for Cape Town, but he'd told Juan about North Korea and Venezuela to get him to turn back.
Do the right thing, Juan's father had often told him. The consequences are easier to deal with, no matter what you think.
He dressed quickly and was in the op center with a cup of coffee from a silver urn on a back table. With the ship firmly grounded, Maurice had pulled out their finest Royal Dalton. It was the steward's subtle way of getting back at him for his earlier crack. If Juan recalled properly, the cup in his hand had cost $75.
How did Mike and his team make out? He asked.
Murph and Stoney were in their customary seats toward the front of the room.
They got back at about 4 this morning, Eric Stone replied. He left word that it went well, but they need at least one more night.
But there's a problem.
Isn't there always?
The workboat with the sonar gear went south this morning.
Juan cursed. If he could find the wreck in a submersible so quickly, it was a safe assumption that the Chinese would too.
I bet the other bay is iced over, so they're checking on the right one.
What do you want to do about it? Mark asked.
Not sure, Juan replied. We can't catch them in either of the submersibles, and if we go after them in an RHIB, they might radio back to base about an unknown craft approaching them.
Ali Kassim was sitting at his customary station. He offered,
So what if they find it today?
All they'll be able to do is take some grainy underwater pictures.
It proves nothing, and by this time tomorrow, the wreck will be destroyed.
Playing devil's advocate, Eric said, if they find the wreck, who's to say they don't stay overnight? That'll mess up our schedule.
Juan felt the beginnings of a headache and rubbed his temples absently.
Of course, there was the other problem that he had no idea how to tackle. He'd already run his idea by Kevin Nixon, but the special effects master said any fakes he made would be spotted in a second. It was the real deal or nothing. For their plan to work so the Argentines never suspected a thing, Cabrillo needed to find 18 human skeletons. The headache was morphing into a migraine.